The president-elect recently tweeted that people who burn the American flag should be punished with either jail time or being stripped of their citizenship, which raised concerns about possible threats to our First Amendment freedoms. Joining us now is Jeffrey Toobin, author of numerous books, a staff writer at The New Yorker, and senior legal analyst at CNN. His recent article, When Truth Is Not Enough, is about the legal victory of attorney Charles Harder that led to the end of Gawker and what that means for journalists who rely on the right to free speech. It's available online as Gawker's Demise and the Trump Era Threat to the First Amendment. I'm very pleased that it brings Jeffrey Toobin back to our show. Hi.
Hi, Leonard.
And you were on CNN to discuss what Donald Trump wrote about burning flags. And
God, that was so many tweets ago. I barely remember that one. Yes, but that's true. He did complain about the burning of the American flag.
The big question asked was, should his words be interpreted as a sign of intent or simply another example of the way that he tweets about things?
Well, I think it's a combination of both. I think, as I suspect most of your learned audience knows, there are several Supreme Court cases that say flag burning is protected expression under the First Amendment. So I don't think there is any immediate threat of flag burners being sent to prison. Not that there are many flag burners to start with, but I think the subtext of his hostility to the First Amendment, to reporters, to the media in general, is a serious part of his appeal. And so I think that's something that's very much worth thinking about as we proceed into the Trump era.
Well, one of his stated heroes, the late Antonin Scalia, was a crucial vote supporting the majority in the two cases that said that flag burning was protected by the First Amendment. But could another flag burning case be brought before the Supreme Court?
You know,
or is the matter settled?
I think the issue is settled. I mean, even the flag burning that ostensibly prompted Trump's tweet was a marginal enterprise at a college in Massachusetts. No one paid much attention to it. So I don't think flag burning per se is much of an issue. But I do think for the First Amendment is in a different place now than it was perhaps before November.
You write that on the campaign trail, I'm quoting, pointing to the journalists, Trump would call them disgusting reporters, horrible people, and scum. As president-elect, he has used his platform and his Twitter feed to tap a deep reservoir of cultural resentment against, among other flag burners, the cast of Hamilton and the staff of the New York Times. But don't all presidents come to feel that the press is their enemy? Is the battle just being enjoined a little earlier than usual?
No, I think it's different. I think you're right that virtually all presidents harbor resentments against individual reporters, individual publications. But when you saw—
They don't like being criticized for things that they feel very strongly about.
Yeah, that would be, to me, describe most human beings who don't like being criticized about things they feel strongly about. But I do think when you saw a Trump rally and you saw him point to the entire press corps and say they're scum, they're liars, etc., that's different. And I think, you know— And I don't think Trump is alone in feeling that way. I mean, I think that's something that's important for those of us who are reporters to acknowledge, that he is tapping into real feelings of hostility to the broader news media.
But has any previous president done anything similar? Whenever people write about it, they cite leaders in other countries. But I can't think of any president who actually called the press corps scum.
No, I think you know, Trump's language is different. I also think, you know, he is going to have a tougher time changing the First Amendment than he is to take health insurance away from poor people. I think that will be a lot easier for him to do. But, you know, presidents also set a tone and also, you know, they appoint judges. So, you know, Trump has said at various times that he wants libel suits to be easier to bring. You know, he doesn't have the power to do that. But, you know, presidents do have a pretty big range of authority, and I think, you know, the First Amendment is one area where it'll have some impact.
Libel suits are easier to bring in Great Britain.
Much.
So I guess he could cite a precedent there, but some people are urging the media not to normalize his presidency. What do you believe the strategy in covering him should be?
You know, I think it's a really difficult question, and I don't think I've figured it out. I don't think the news media has figured it out. You know, normalize has become a big buzzword. I don't think you can pretend he's not president. I don't think you can pretend that he's not, you know, going to exercise the powers the way any president does. But you know, I do think one way the press has changed is that we are more willing to call out false statements by him than we had been with public figures previously. You know, there is, at least on a in a big part of the press, and I think this is certainly true of CNN where I work, a real sort of genetic disposition to give both sides of every story. That's something that we're trained to do. But there have been more and more occasions where my colleagues and I think quite appropriately say, you know, what he's saying is simply not true.
But he's also facing a kind of hostility I can't remember any other president facing. For example, the late night shows, Seth Meyers, Stephen Colbert, Trevor Noah, Samantha Bee, they ridicule him pretty much every night.
It is pretty extraordinary. And when you think about celebrities, you know, there are essentially no celebrities of any magnitude who have supported Donald Trump. And Hillary Clinton had this incredible array of celebrities. It's sort of like newspaper endorsements. You know, there was one newspaper in the United States, Sheldon Adelson's newspaper in Nevada, that was the only newspaper to endorse Donald Trump. I think one of the things we've learned from Trump's victory is that not only do newspaper endorsements and celebrities not mean much, there may be a real backlash to this sort of against what many people regard as elitist sentiment against Trump in favor of Clinton.
And let's get to that elitist sentiment in just a moment. My guest is Jeffrey Toobin, who's been a staff writer at The New Yorker since 1993, the legal analyst for CNN since 2002, after 6 years at ABC News, the author of many books and articles. And the article that inspired this visit is When Truth Is Not Enough. It was in The New Yorker. The online version is Gawker's Demise and the Trump Era Threat to the First Amendment. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. The subtitle of the article on Gawker's Demise is Hulk Hogan's Smashing Legal Victory Shows Us That Publishing the Truth May No Longer Be Enough. So what are the new limits?
Well, let me just give you a PG-rated version of what the Hulk Hogan case was about, which I think is the important context here. Hulk Hogan is a famous professional wrestler, and he lives in Tampa, and he had a best friend whose name, and you know, I'm not making this up, his actual name is Bubba the Love Sponge, who is a radio DJ. It was really a
Bubba Clem.
That was his old name, and it gives me so much more pleasure to say Bubba the Love Sponge.
But don't you want to tell us Hulk Hogan's real name?
Well, his name is much less interesting. His name is Terry Bollea. That's his real name. Hulk Hogan is his wrestling name. But in 2007, for reasons too bizarre to go into, Bubba the Love Sponge persuaded Hulk Hogan to have sex with Bubba's wife. They had an open marriage, and unknown, apparently, to Hulk Hogan, there was a video of the two of them having sex. Years later, in 2012, I think, someone leaked the video, the sex tape, to Gawker, which was a website that it's very difficult to describe what Gawker was. It was sort of a mix of politics and gossip and high and low, mostly low, but you know, a very energetic website that was full of sort of hostility and contempt for celebrities. And they ran a minute and a half of a 30-minute video of Hulk Hogan having sex. that was the basis for this whole legal controversy.
And to some degree, your article is a defense of Harker's right, although they...
it's a mixed bag.
You were a victim as well.
Yeah, I mean, they wrote nasty stuff about me, which was fine. I mean, I think it's important to... what makes... I mean, First Amendment law is often made by distasteful subjects, you know, people who are pushing the envelope. And the interesting thing about this case was that it was not a libel suit, which is the traditional way the press gets sued for saying something false and defamatory. It was an invasion of privacy lawsuit, which is a different kind of tort law. And the claim was not, as in a libel suit, that the tape was false, was that it violated Hulk Hogan's privacy.
But there are a lot more complications to it. One argument made is that Hulk Hogan is an invented character. Does that mean that there are extra protections afforded to Terry Bollea that don't apply to the character he has created?
Well, that to me was one of the most bold and, frankly, I thought unpersuasive, at least to me, arguments, that basically Hulk Hogan had in public discussed a lot of sexual details from his personal life. And the Gawker lawyers in this lawsuit in Florida said, wait a minute, how can you say your privacy is violated when you yourself have talked about all these sexual details? And at the lawsuit, Hulk Hogan testified that no, the character Hulk Hogan had talked about his sex life. Me, Terry Bollea, had never talked about my sex life. And this sex tape violated the privacy of Terry Bollea, not of Hulk Hogan.
Complicating it even further, Bubba Love Sponge.
Bubba the Love Sponge.
The Love Sponge had been friends with do I want to say Hulk Hogan, for years, partly connected through an incident that involved Hulk's son, Nick Hogan, who was the driver in a car accident in which a passenger was seriously injured, and he wound up serving 18 months in jail. But
Nick did, yes.
Yeah, but Bubba the Love Sponge came to his defense. I have a couple of questions. Why is Hulk's son named Nick Hogan and not Nick Bollea?
Well, that was part of Gawker's argument in the case, is that there was no such thing as a distinction between Terry Bollea and Hulk Hogan. You know, Hulk Hogan was the person, and you know, his wife was Linda Hogan, as his son was Nick Hogan. He had a reality show that was included his personal life, including going to a marriage therapist with Linda Hogan as Hulk Hogan. So, I mean, I thought, frankly, it was a bogus argument made to the jury that Hulk Hogan and Terry Bollea were different people, but the jury clearly bought it.
Did the fact that video was made available suggest that Hulk Hogan and Love Sponge are no longer friends?
Yes, this did create a breach in their friendship. And in fact, Hulk Hogan also sued Bubba the Love Sponge in connection with this incident. That settled rather than went to trial.
Do we know if he's the one who mailed the DVD of the video to A.J. Delario, who was then the editor of Gawker?
One of the enduring mysteries of this bizarre case is that no one to this day, and that includes me, knows who actually sent the DVD with the sex tape to Gawker. But Gawker ran a lot of sex tapes. It wasn't the only thing they ran, but you know, people in embarrassing positions, not erotica, but basically mocking sex tapes.
They said they were against hypocrisy.
Yeah, I don't quite understand what that means. It's not like Hulk Hogan was being so hypocritical. I think they just wanted to make fun of Hulk Hogan because they made fun of people. They made fun of me on occasion. They made fun of the New Yorker.
I'm not famous enough.
Count your blessings, Mr. Lopez. It was no surprise that out of all the places, whoever it was wanted to mail this DVD, they sent it to Gawker.
And it got 5 million page views, which would have suggested that it was a huge success for Gawker. But then that backfired.
It backfired in a huge way. That Hulk Hogan wound up hiring this Beverly Hills attorney, Charles Hoder, and they sued in federal court initially. They were thrown out of federal court on traditional First Amendment grounds that, look, this was a matter of public interest. You can't sue for this. But they filed a separate case in Florida state court, and that's the one that went to trial.
How important is the fact that Hulk Hogan had many fans who were really upset by the fact that this video had been posted?
Very. I think that was very significant because – and especially – you know, the Hogan's lawyers chose the location for this lawsuit with care. Hulk Hogan, you know, is a pretty well-known person nationwide, but he's a big popular celebrity in Tampa, and he's born and raised there, and he was kind of a hometown hero. So the fact that it was Hulk Hogan, you know, with a home field advantage against this, you know, group of Ivy League British outsiders from New York was a big part of how the trial unfolded.
Let's take a little break and we'll come back to those British outsiders in New York. My guest is Jeffrey Toobin, whose recent article, When Truth Is Not Enough, is also available online as Gawker's Demise and the Trump Era Threat to the First Amendment. We will continue right after this. And we're back with Jeffrey Toobin. We are talking about possible threats to the First Amendment in the upcoming years. But the case we're discussing is the Gawker case. Was Nick Denton, the founder of Gawker Media, perhaps out of touch with his audience when he posted that and so many were upset by the fact that he had?
Well, I think you used an interesting word in that question. You say, was he out of touch with his audience? I don't think he was out of touch with his audience. His audience, as he said, when I spoke to him, was young and metropolitan and worldly and cynical. But, you know, the internet doesn't just go to the intended audience. Anybody can access a website. And I think what Nick and A.J. Delario, who was the editor who actually put the tape on the website, is that they didn't realize how they would be viewed outside their own very clearly defined bubble. And that's what really sunk Gawker.
One issue that came up at the trial is that his staff at Gawker was selected from some of the most elite colleges in America. He was educated at Oxford and had worked at places like the Financial Times.
Right. But you know, and Nick is really a very interesting person. Gawker isn't the only website he founded. The others include Jalopnik about cars, Gizmodo about gizmos, and Deadspin about sports. I mean, he really had a tremendous, you know, he was a creator of websites. But Gawker was always sort of the evil stepchild, the most risque, the most cynical. And I think they ultimately crossed the line in such a dramatic way. You know, whether they crossed the line in such a way that they should have been driven out of business is very much a separate question. But certainly I think it was not such a smart thing and not a great idea to publish this website.
Were his other
sex video?
His other websites successful?
By and large, they have been successful. In the financial crisis created by this lawsuit, Gawker itself, as a website, has gone out of business. But all the others have been sold to Univision, and they continue to be out there.
And why did he create Gawker then? Because he says he believes in transparency?
Yeah, I mean, I would take some of the more highfalutin things Nick says with a grain of salt. He created Gawker for the same reason that most business people create projects, which is he thought he'd make money. And he did for a long time. He thought that the sort of cynical take on celebrity culture, on popular culture, would draw an audience and thus advertising, and he did.
It was an upscale National Enquirer.
You know, I it's
the sensibility was very different, although some of the things they covered from the National Enquirer, it was more meta than that. It was sort of about the National Enquirer and about gossip culture rather than reflecting gossip culture.
Some of the things, his public remarks about his publication probably didn't do him any favors at the trial. He said, "We don't seek to do good." And when he was asked by an interviewer from Playboy if he ever had misgivings about exposing people's sex lives, he said, "If there is a gap between your private behavior and your public status, that's what makes the story for us."
See, that's, to me, was just ridiculous. I mean, that's a bogus justification for what they did. He wasn't making a larger point when he was running these sex takes about hypocrisy. He was just making fun of people. Now, the First Amendment, by and large, allows you to make fun of people, but I don't think you need to invest it with sort of, you know, these fancy justifications, you know, about piercing hypocrisy. I think they did it because they thought it was funny.
You've described Hogan's trial as a dress rehearsal for Clinton versus Trump. How significant is it that it took place against the backdrop of Trump's campaign?
Well, that was the thing that I thought elevated this kind of goofy trial to a more interesting and significant level. When you look at how Charles Harder and the team, his legal team in Tampa, argued this case, it was very much a populists versus elitist argument.
You know, Hulk Hogan is an everyman.
Exactly.
But he's a very rich guy.
You know, so is Donald Trump. And the argument that these elitists from New York were embarrassing someone who made it by the skill, you know, by the basis of his own skill and talent, and these mocking outsiders. You know, one of my favorite facts in the case is that in the closing argument by Hogan's lawyers, he mentioned three times that the Gawker offices were on Fifth Avenue. You know, those people up in Fifth Avenue, you know, they may think that we're all degenerates, but we're not. And I thought that was
Donald Trump's Trump Towers on Fifth Avenue.
Trump Towers on Fifth Avenue. But I mean, you know, the genius, and, you know, that word is, you know, I use that word advisedly, of the Trump campaign is that as a, you know, putative billionaire, he managed to tap into this resentment of people against elites. And that was precisely how Hogan's lawyers won the case.
Didn't David Hewson, Hogan's personal lawyer, ask Gawker to take down the video?
He did, and
so Gawker, why didn't they?
Well, because that. I mean, and here's one place where I give Nick Denton credit. One of the signatures of Gawker was, you know, when famous or rich people asked them to do things, they told them to go to hell. I mean, they had their own editorial standards, and then obviously this was a mistake, but Nick didn't respond when famous people or lawyers said, "Do me a favor, protect my client." He was not interested in protecting people.
And as you said earlier, Hogan ran into some trouble for their case when in November 2012, James D. Whitmore, a federal judge in Tampa, denied his request that Gawker take down the tape. And so Nick Denton just thought the whole thing was over then?
You know, it was easy to think that the whole thing was over. And you know, the federal court, I mean, again, it's a difference between elites and popular. You know, judges have been very protective of the First Amendment, like the federal judge in this case. Judges can step back and say, you know, we may not approve of this particular publication or this website, but we recognize that the First Amendment protects a lot of a lot of vulgar commentary and coverage. But once this case got before a jury in state court of regular people, they were outraged, and that is what sunk Gawker. And again, I think it plays into this theme of populism versus elites, that Gawker did well with judges but poorly with jurors.
Also, his past activities with Valleywag, which was a site that grew out of his early career covering Silicon Valley for Financial Times.
Right.
That got him into trouble because he angered the wrong man.
He angered the wrong man. Peter Thiel, who is was one of the founders of PayPal and early investors in Facebook, billionaire, big Trump supporter,
who secretly decided to fund the lawsuit against Gawker.
And why? Because they had written things like a Facebook billionaire's big dumb failure, or Facebook backer wishes women couldn't vote, or outed him as gay. But Denton is also gay.
Well, that doesn't mean that Peter Thiel enjoyed being outed. The fact that Nick Denton is also gay. I mean, I think there's a whole literature on outing. It is certainly the view of most journalists I know that it's up to individuals to decide whether they want to make their sexuality public. This was an example of the radical transparency of Gawker. The fact that they outed Peter Thiel. I mean, I actually think their coverage of Peter Thiel's financial business was really excellent journalism. I mean, they really did good journalism on Thiel. I don't support their decision to out Peter Thiel. I think that's just not the way journalists should operate. But the net effect of it all was that it turned Peter Thiel into this vengeful figure who secretly funded the case against Gawker.
And he was Silicon Valley's most vocal supporter of Trump. He even gave a speech for Trump at the Republican convention, despite the fact that there were any number of people at that convention who were accused of being homophobic.
Peter Thiel is an eccentric figure in Silicon Valley. I don't know if you remember a couple of weeks ago when Trump met with a bunch of Silicon Valley executives, Peter Thiel was seated right next to Trump. But I think in the person of Peter Thiel, you see the nexus between the plaintiff side in the Hogan lawsuit and the Trump campaign most explicitly, because Thiel is the connection between the two.
When the case moved forward, one of the key issues was whether a sex tape is news. Is it?
Tough question, isn't it? I mean, it really is a hard question, and that's really what the case came down to. Gawker's lawyers argued that Hulk Hogan had made his sexuality part of his act, so it was newsworthy. The plaintiffs argued, "Come on, it's one thing to talk on the radio about women you find sexy or we prize sexual conduct. It's another to broadcast the most intimate acts two people can engage in." And there, I think, Gawker was in real trouble. I think it's tough to argue that a surreptitiously taken sex tape is newsworthy of anyone.
Peter Thiel said, "It's not about the First Amendment. It's about the most egregious violation of privacy imaginable, publishing a sex tape surreptitiously done in the privacy of someone's bedroom. And to hide behind the First Amendment, behind journalism, that's an insult to journalists." But you quote Amy Guida, First Amendment expert, who said, "Courts are now viewing newsworthiness in a dangerously subjective way to show that today's internet-based media sometimes doesn't have the same ethics constraints as more mainstream media, leading to a more judgmental bench eager to question news value. And this is what the Gawker case is all about."
See, this is what I found particularly interesting about this moment in First Amendment history. Most of the big First Amendment cases in the history of the Supreme Court involve newspapers. The most famous is New York Times against Sullivan, a libel suit filed in the height of the civil rights movement. And basically what courts said in a lot of these lawsuits is, look, we are not going to second guess the editors of newspapers of what's newsworthy. And the implication was that newspapers were responsible members of the community. What's different now with the internet is that everybody's a publisher. Everybody can claim the First Amendment. And when you have things like revenge porn, people putting up photographs, videos of their ex-lovers in incredibly embarrassing positions, that...
And providing personal details as well, and sometimes addresses.
Right. I mean, that, no judge is going to say that's protected by the First Amendment. So the question is Gawker more like a newspaper publisher or more like a revenge porn distributor?
Well, a listener says the whole matter is not so much what Gawker says, but what matters is that a bad judge and a bad jury screwed the First Amendment.
You know, I certainly think. I mean, just to cut to the chase, the jury awarded $150 million in damages, which I thought was absurdly egregiously too much.
Does Hulk Hogan get most of that money? Well, Gawker wouldn't have had $150 million.
Well, long story short, Gawker had to declare bankruptcy, and ultimately the case settled for $31 million. Hogan got $31 million minus attorney's fees. So he got an enormous amount of money, which I don't think he deserved. So I think the damage award was unquestionably excessive. Liability, I'm not so sure the jury was wrong. I mean, I think it is difficult to argue the newsworthiness of the sex tape, but certainly the damage award was wildly excessive.
How about the use of freelancers in the media? Are they held to different standards than salaried employees, especially when it comes to online publications?
Well,
often they're not even paid.
Right. I mean, I think the short answer is no. I mean, and this is the risk that publications take from relying on so much on freelancers, which many of them do, is that they are not familiar with the same standards as staffers, and but if you libel someone or violate someone's privacy in an article or in a public, the plaintiff doesn't have to care whether it was done by a freelancer or a staff member. That's the violation is the violation if one can be found.
Some people also feel that the press really screwed up during the election. They focused on certain kinds of things about Trump and not others. They dismissed Bernie Sanders' ideas. They just kept on insisting that Hillary Clinton had a 98% chance of winning.
Alternatively, there are other views that the press focused excessively on her emails and the Clinton Foundation and created a false equivalence between Trump's ethical problems and Hillary's ethical problems. So there is no shortage of criticism of how we covered this campaign.
To be continued. Jeffrey Toobin is a staff writer at The New Yorker and also is a legal analyst at CNN. We've been talking about his article, When Truth Is Not Enough. And I thank you so much for being on our show
Good
again.
To be back, Mr. Lopate.